Hi, today's May 17th, 2020. This is Mobile News Podcast 327. Boy, that was kind of hard to say. I'm Todd Ogasawara. I'm
your friend John Westfall. Call us a podcast.
Hey,
well, a podcast or a codcast. I think we're a fishing show now.
We don't have. Do we have cod in Hawaii? I don't think so. I think that's an East Coast thing, right? Or Atlantic thing. But any rate, before we begin, I almost forgot. I didn't put it in the show notes, but I should mention in my other podcast, Comics News, which I co-host with my old friend Jay Stone. Shout out to Jay. His daughter just graduated last night with her PhD in pharmacology. So congratulations to Jay's family and to the new Dr. Stone. Anyway, so more good news aside from Jay's. Maybe not quite as good as Jay's, but my iPad Pro 11-inch 2020 model, which I just got weeks ago, got replaced. So it was, I think I mentioned it on a podcast a couple of weeks ago, that it was spontaneously shutting down and rebooting. And there was no rhyme or reason to it. I thought at first it was like apps that made heavy use of memory, like drawing apps and so forth. But sometimes it'd be sitting on home screen and just shut down. So it took me three tries talking to three different Apple support people. But I was able to finally get resolution to have mine shipped back. And it was not even cross-shipped. So they sent me one. I put it back in a box and sent it back out while I started to set up the new one. And although I was advised to build new, because they thought my old one, there was nothing, well, at any rate, it didn't work on my old one. So I just restored it from my iPad, my previous iPad, my 10.5, the 2017 model. And so far it's been stable since, when did I get it? Like Saturday, maybe? Something like that. So, yay! I have a functional iPad Pro 11 now, and it's pretty interesting. I will talk a bit more about the difference between that and other devices, and a conundrum I now have with another toy I'm thinking about buying. But anyway, moving on to that. Boy, this one, okay, this is going to raise my blood pressure. So our friend Chris Spera, who's been on the podcast before, Chris mentioned to me that, hey, did you read that Google Play Music is going away for sure again this year? And, you know, Google's been threatening that for a long time. And, of course, they are the killer of products. So Google Play Music is going to go away to replace what I consider to be the awful and inferior YouTube Music app. And Chris says, so, at any rate, so you can transfer everything from Google Play Music, because why it's not already synchronized, I don't know. You know, why would you not want it synchronized just automatically? But apparently there's supposed to be a transfer button on the YouTube Music app, whichever one you use. And in my case, it'd be iPad OS. But it's not there, so I can't test a switch. But I think we'll ask Chris on to see his thoughts on this when my button appears, and maybe we can rant at each other or something. John, you don't use Google Play Music, right? So you're okay. This is not something that bothers you.
You know, I played with it years ago when it very first came out, and I was still on Android. And I thought for a while that was going to be what I used forever, because I liked that it was more cross-platform. Yeah. At the time, I had a lot more devices that were – and this is obviously before Apple Music or even I think iTunes Match was even a thing.
I think so.
So it was, you know, you could upload your own stuff, and that was great. So I'm kind of really annoyed by this, because it really was the only other robust enough competitor to iTunes, I thought.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, I'm happy on iTunes, but that's also because I live in predominantly a Apple ecosystem, and there is now Apple Music on the web. So when I'm on a Windows machine, I can launch Apple Music, but I don't know. It annoys me how Google just takes these things that really I don't think would make too much effort to merge and just kills one of them and you have to go with the other.
Right. And the fact that they don't just synchronize it, you know, I mean, just automatically, they're both music apps. Why make it a complete manual action by the part of the user when you know you're going to kill one app anyway? Just make it simple. Say, hey, you know what? You're going to be transferred to Google Music. It'll happen on this date. So, you know, stay tuned, so to speak. But at any rate, I don't have a button to transfer my, my, I don't know when this is going to happen. I saw there's a YouTube on Google blog. There's a YouTube notice about Google Play Music going away, and you know that we're going to be forced to switch to YouTube Music and to look for the transfer button, which I don't have. I haven't looked at it on my Android device, mostly because I don't want to install it on my Pixel. What do I have, a 3A phone? Because it only has 64 gigs of storage and it's pretty much full, so I don't want to have music or anything else accidentally download to it, so, or even install another app. Anywho, yeah, so that's it. By the way, I heard, what is it, a new Pixel 4a or whatever is coming out later this year might be cheap, so maybe I can replace my Pixel 3a with a inexpensive 4a, so we'll see. Although I think I'm out of step for upgrading my Android. It's my year to upgrade iPhone, so it might be a very expensive year, but we can talk about expensive years coming up too. Next item is something, you know, so I've been kind of talking about the Lenovo Chromebook Duet with you, John, and it's sort of like the Google Pixel Slate. It's a tablet that you can attach a physical keyboard to, has a touch screen, you know, obviously it's a tablet, has its touch screen yet. And, but the great thing about it is its price. It's, I think, $279 for the base model with 64 gigs of storage and $300 for the larger model, 128 gigabytes of storage, which I think is eMMC, not SSD. But at any rate, It's a 10-inch device, so you know it's roughly the size of an iPad in screen size, roughly. And I really like Chromebooks, as you know. I've got three of them, one of which I keep at the office all the time now, as sort of just to carry around with me that has a good keyboard or reasonable keyboard, maybe not a good keyboard. But the thing is, the Chromebook Duet from Lenovo has kind of a pokey ARM-based processor. And one of the things I've noticed recently, anyway, at any rate, since this whole COVID-19 crisis started, and I started using my Chromebook exclusively at work for a lot of reasons, but I'm not using my Windows device at work anymore. And it is kind of pokey when you're trying to do a lot on it. It's okay if you're just taking it to a meeting and take some notes, pop up a few browser tabs, but the minute you start trying to run Microsoft Teams and having voice chats and multiple spreadsheets and all kinds of other stuff, it gets kind of pokey. It's, you know, it's really not designed for that, in my opinion. And so I started looking around and I saw Kevin Toffel, you know, about Chromebooks.com, had a, he's a big name now in Chromebooks. So Google actually sent him one to review, even though most of us can't even find one to buy. And he did a, you know, actually he's not calling a review because he likes to really play with something before he calls a review. He calls it a first impression, I think. And he notes that although he's not a fan of benchmarks, he did run, because everybody asks, just like, you know, people like me always ask, well, what about, you know, how fast is it compared to other stuff? He ran a couple of benchmarks, including Speedometer 2.0, which I chose as a representative of the various benchmarks, because I'm just too lazy to run all of them like Kevin. And he said that the Duet clocked in at 46.07. So I said, well, what does that mean? You know, I don't know what that means. And he compared it to some other Chromebooks, which helped me. But then I asked, well, what does it mean compared to other stuff I have that are not Chromebooks? To, you know, which. And so I started with my brand new iPad Pro 11, 2020. And it clocked in at 135. Which is pretty fast. And John, you're saying yours clocked in at 138?
Yeah, older one. I've been running them right now as we've been talking. And so, yeah, it clocked in at 138.
Yeah, and your results will obviously vary. I don't know why, but they do vary. And because here's one that, so ours is not too far apart, right? Although you would think mine would be a little faster because I think I have a newer CPU. But that said, Kevin and I do have one common device. He clocked in Acer's Chromebook Spin 13, and we have, there are various models I know, but we have the exact same one, i5, blah, blah, blah. And his clocked in at 104, while mine was 61.80, so significantly different. I should note, I'm using the web browser-based test. I'm not installing the benchmark.org app or on my device, and that might be the difference. Maybe I should try that. But in any case, so I just went to the website to test it, browserbench.org. And, you know, it's interesting. So a Fire HD, the Amazon Fire HD tablet, came in at 8.45, you know, compared to the 135 iPad Pro. And it kind of feels pokey. But so the one, the slow Chromebook, my very first Chromebook, Samsung Chromebook Plus from 2017, is 17.40. Again, compare that to 135 from my iPad 11 Pro, and compared to the 61 on the Acer ThinkBook 13, or this is sort of interesting, compared to the iPad Mini 5 from 2019, which is 130, so it's right up there with the iPad Pros in terms of browser speed, which, you know, that's all, right? Nothing, doesn't mean anything else will be that fast. Although the iPad Mini 5 is pretty responsive. Anyway, so now I'm concerned, you know, if I buy the Chromebook Duet, it really won't replace the Lenovo C330 I have now, because I haven't benchmarked that since it's sitting in the office. I have to go in and test it. But I suspect it'll be pretty pokey. You know, I suspect it'll be down in the 20 to 40 range. And if the Chromebook Duet is at 46, I'm not going to get much of a speed bump for the kinds of stuff I've been doing lately when I'm in the office. So I don't know what to do. I hate to spend another $500-$600 on a decent Chromebook. Like the Acer Chromebook Spin 13, which I think I paid about $600 for on sale, is awesome. It's really fast. There's no noticeable lag when I'm doing lots and lots of stuff on it. And no, I don't want to buy another MacBook because that's too expensive. I don't want to buy a Windows device because it's just too much trouble to, you know, self-maintain. I guess I could ask, you know, my employers to buy another notebook, but that seems silly since I already have one that works. It's just that I'm not keeping it in the office right now since I'm doing most of my work at home these days. Any rate, I don't know. What do you think, John? I can see the difference in the Chromebook Plus versus, you know, like everything else.
Well, and I think it has a lot to do with what else is, you know, the memory management of the devices. We know that iOS is, in many ways, brutal on memory management. You know, something is taking up even a little bit too much memory, it gets killed. We know that there was the bug a few years ago where things were getting killed way more than they should be. We had a couple of weeks there where I think it was one of the dot releases of iOS 12 was just like brutal. It just, you know, if you didn't use an app for a couple seconds, it was taken out of memory.
Yeah.
So I think the memory management model really has a lot to do with it, because I also tried running this on my MacBook Pro 2015, yeah, which it wouldn't even get through 100 of the tests of the 400 tests before I finished. I said no more with it, because it just, you know, with another tab open, with Skype up and running, with other things running on the computer, it couldn't do anything. So I think what we're really seeing with those tests are not so much the speed of the browser, but the memory management of the device. And desktops manage memory a lot different. iOS is very brutal on memory management. Android, it really depends on the distribution of Android and how the, you know, it's been tweaked. So that's what I think we're seeing with these. And, you know, I wouldn't think there's really any difference between the 135 you got on the 2020 11 inch and I, you know, 138 on the 2018 11 inch. I think it's just, and it probably also has a lot to do with what plugins you have running in your browser.
Yeah, well, on iPad Pro, it's just Safari, so I don't have any plugins.
Yeah.
But, at least I don't think I have any plugins on the browser. Does Safari for the iPad even have plugins? I'm not even sure. I never thought about that. Except for whatchamacallit, adware stuff, right? If you have that turned on. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, anyway, it was an interesting exercise to run into a couple of things I have just to, you know, get a feel for what the numbers mean for stuff I've got experience with. I'm still thinking about it. I really like the idea of the Chromebook Duet. I like the idea of trying a more tablet-ish Chromebook. I should note that the Chromebooks I have now all have touchscreens. Two of them support stylus. The Chromebook Duet does not apparently support an active stylus, which is a little bit disappointing, but maybe it reflects the low-end processor and the hit it would take to deal with an active stylus interface. But I got to think about it. Otherwise, I'll I'll scrape together some money and maybe buy a new Chromebook, a little higher end Chromebook, just to get some speed when I'm in the office. Or hope that COVID-19 goes away like in the next couple of weeks. But, you know, I think that's kind of wishful thinking. So
we can always hope.
Yeah. Okay. More Apple-y stuff I see on our list.
Yeah. So this week in adventures in COVID-19, I decided I should probably start going out for walks more often
and
trying to get some exercise. So I usually when I go for a walk, I'm walking from places I have to go. I'm not just going for a walk. So right. I usually always have my phone with me. And I was doing that for a couple of days, and I realized I have an Apple Watch with cellular. I have AirPods. Why am I taking the phone with me? It's just more on me that I would rather, you know, not have. Plus, for whatever reason, when I put a phone in the shorts that I wear, I can feel it bouncing against my leg, and that can't be good for it to be repeatedly like bounced up and down and all that. And a couple of years ago, I actually had a screen delaminate from my iPhone 10. I think it was last fall, actually.
I don't remember that.
And I had it swapped out. Yeah, it was. If you go back in the show notes, you'll find it. That's also one of the reasons why I haven't been in a hurry to upgrade my iPhone 10, because I got a de facto battery replacement when I got a refurbished unit. So I thought, well, maybe that had something to do with it, this like continual bouncing that it's been doing up against my leg. So a couple of days ago, for the first time, I just went out with the Apple Watch, which has cellular, and the AirPods. And a couple of interesting things I've realized, because I've done this a few times in the past. I think the most recent, when I was at the beach a few years ago, my iPhone would just overheat because it was sitting in my bag on, you know, at the beach. So I just started turning my iPhone off and going off of cellular on my watch. The first day I went out, I was able to get a podcast up and running using the Overcast podcast player that I believe you and I both use. The interface was a little weird in that I accidentally, before I got out of range of my iPhone, started the podcast on my iPhone.
Uh-oh.
So I actually have to go do a little toggle in the interface to go Apple Watch versus iPhone. And then I texted my wife while I was walking using Siri saying, hey, did I turn an podcast on my iPhone while I was gone? And when I didn't get a response, I called her and she said, oh yeah, you did. I turned it off and I texted you back. Well, that text never came through to my watch.
Oh, why not? Kind
of, yeah, no idea. That sort of was a weird quirk of it. But calling her by using my AirPods and going through the watch, that worked without a problem. The next day I went out, I couldn't get Overcast. Whatever. Yeah, Overcast. I couldn't get it to actually do a podcast, even though they're downloaded to the watch. So I went to Apple Music. That worked just fine. Today, I think I figured it out. I think I have to get out of range of my Wi-Fi and my Apple, my iPhone, before I start doing anything with the watch, other than starting my workout. So I start the workout. I get, you know, a minute or so away from home. Then I can get the iOS or the Overcast client to start streaming my podcast and all that. But it is interesting, and I assume people who do these workouts regularly have noticed some of these strange bugs and peculiarities. But for me, I'm looking forward to over the next couple of weeks figuring it out more, because it is a really slick thing once you have it up and running. That all I take when I go out is my watch, my AirPods, and a key to get back in. Now, it would be really nice if more of the local retailers downtown offered Apple Pay, because then if I wanted to, I could, you know, pick up a drink or something, or scream or whatever, totally defeating the whole point of going out for a walk, but I could do those things.
Well, you need to hydrate.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. Ever since the Series 3, I've bought the Apple Watches with cellular, mostly because they just come with it, because I usually buy the stainless steel. And I realized I'm kind of paying for something I'm not using that much. So maybe I'll try to start using it a little more as a cellular device versus just a Wi-Fi device.
You know, the text notification thing really interests me, because I don't have an Apple Watch with LTE. I just have a Wi-Fi one. But I have had lots of problems with where notifications go. You know, when people send me a message or respond to me. So in particular, for some reason, my wife's messages go go to all kinds of devices, but not all at the same time. So I might send a text message from my iPhone to her, for example, and the response might go to my iPad, but not my iPhone. And then my MacBook Pro, which, as you know, has messages on it, it's kind of spotty. Lately, I'm just kind of looking at it now. Lately, it looks a little bit better, but it's still not perfect. And I still can't quite figure out why some messages come to my MacBook and some don't, why some go to my iPad Pro and not my iPhone. And sometimes, like I said, I'll send a message from one device and the response will come back to another one. So, which is kind of like what happened to you. You sent it from your watch, but the response only went back to your phone and not both your watch and your phone, which is what you would hope for.
A couple interesting things I'm noticing in iMessage right now. I just opened the iMessage client on my MacBook Pro.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Sync Now button in the iMessage tab and preferences that I've never noticed before. So apparently Apple has slipped that in there at some point for people who are noticing a weird sync issue with
their... Where's the Sync Now?
Into Messages, yep. Preferences, and then the iMessage tab under Settings.
Okay, iMessage tab.
Enable messages
now. I'm going to do it.
I'm wondering if that has a little bit to do with it. And then I also realized, so last year at some point, I had a real problem with iMessage on an old MacBook Air. My 2011 MacBook Air that I keep at work all the time was not syncing to iMessage at all. It was just really a pain, and I was getting all these weird messages. I would sign it out. Try to sign it back in. It wouldn't do it, etc. What I eventually realized was that there was some DNS setting that my corporate firewall must have just clashed with Apple over. So what I ended up doing, this sounds weird, I tethered the MacBook Air to my iPhone. So I had a connection to the internet that was not going through my corporate network and firewall.
Right.
Re-signed into iMessage. It worked just fine. And then went back to regular Wi-Fi at my office, and it kept working. So it was the most annoying. It was literally weeks I spent troubleshooting this. And then once I got it fixed, it was all so simple. Just tether it to an actual cellular connection, sign it in, and then it was up okay. So... And I think it had something to do with the encryption keys that it was downloading and that it wasn't renewing or something like that.
But, right.
iMessage, for all of its niceness in what it can do, it can also be a real bear when it's not working right. When it works right, it's great. When it doesn't work right, it's really annoying to troubleshoot.
All right. Well.
But yeah, I also do the text message forwarding from my iPhone to two devices. And I've also had a few issues where with people who are on SMS, and so it does need to directly connect to my iPhone to send the message out, it will fail from the computer, which is a little annoying as well.
Well, the Sync Now button, I pressed it, and now it's grayed out, so we'll see. I don't see anything. Yeah, I don't see anything different.
We hope. But
we'll find out. That is wild.
It's always interesting when Apple slips those new settings in.
Yeah.
And you start looking at things going, when did that happen?
Yeah. Sync Now. Preferences. Settings. Actually, no, not settings. Messages. Preferences. Sync Now. Okay. Noted that down. We'll see if this helps. I wonder if I guess it's only for the MacBook. I wonder if there's something like that on the...
Did not see it when I was just in the messages setting on my phone.
Yeah, I don't see it. I don't see it.
I wonder if Apple has now made iMessage syncing in the cloud a default or not. Because remember when that rolled out, you had to enable iMessage syncing to the cloud.
Yeah.
And now I wonder if that is a turned on by default thing or still an opt-in thing for Apple.
Yeah, I'm looking at the settings tab in iOS on my iPhone, and I don't see anything that says Sync Now, so we will see. Okay, I should go look at it on my iPad too later on. Okay, good tip. Good real-time tip. And I should learn how to spell preferences. There we go. Alrighty. Next item.
Next item is a little rant about, and we can talk a little bit about Microsoft Office apps and Microsoft apps. So I have noticed from time to time that I use Siri shortcuts to launch a variety of Office documents.
Okay.
So opening up spreadsheets where I track my daily weight and I track my year in pixels and those sorts of things. So at some point I found the URL scheme for the Office apps on iOS, which was not easy to find. I had to go digging around in a bunch of weird places on Microsoft's website to find it. But one of the URL schemes is, you know, MS-Excel, which is to open an Excel spreadsheet.
Makes sense.
Now, you would think that whenever you call that, it would open the Excel spreadsheet in either Excel or the Microsoft Office app on iOS.
Sounds reasonable.
Every so often, I update the OneDrive app.
Right.
I think this is what causes it. And OneDrive hijacks the MS-Excel scheme. And instead of opening it in Excel where I can edit it directly, it opens it in OneDrive.
Huh.
And then I have to get the edit in Excel. And then it does that for a few days until, I suppose, the Microsoft Office app reasserts dominance over the MS-Excel scheme. And I assume this also happens for the MS-PowerPoint and MS-Word URL schemes. But it's just one of those things where it's, come on, Microsoft, why can't your OneDrive app check to see if I have the Office app? And if it does, don't try to hook into those URL schemes because they're already taken by the actual app you would want me to use.
Well, what can I say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly, what Microsoft really should look at doing is merging the Microsoft Office and the OneDrive app. Those are the two apps that wouldn't be bad together.
Well, you know, they're getting closer. So the unified Microsoft app, let me rephrase it. The unified Microsoft Office app, which is available for Android and iOS, actually kind of does that. So if you look at it, it can, the default view is the most recent files that you've worked on in your Office. That's home essentially. And then there's a bunch of actions that, you know, sign and stuff that's kind of unrelated. And then there's a plus sign that lets you create notes, Microsoft, notes being sticky notes, by the way. Microsoft Lens is, and also documents, which then takes you to Word, Excel, or PowerPoint. So it's getting closer. Home is not quite the full OneDrive, but you can see the most recent documents, Excel, Word, PowerPoint, sticky notes is considered a document. That you've opened in, I'm just to see how far back it goes. Looks like it goes back, goes back way far. I'm scrolling back to last year. Okay, it's not just the last couple of files. It's like a long time ago. I'm still scrolling. Mine goes back till, wow, quite far. This is my personal account, I should notice. This is not my work account. It goes back like 2013. So it goes back 6 years from a personal account. Not sure what it looks like on an enterprise account, which may have record retention policies set. So I'm not sure what happens to your documents if you have record retention policies on various kinds of documents. Hopefully it doesn't delete it, but not sure. So it's possible? Don't know. Oh, and by the way, the Unified app will kind of complain if you use it on an iPad, it'll say, hey, you know, this is tuned for an iPhone, blah, blah, blah. But it'll work. I think you may have to double the size so that it fits the screen, but it still works. I've been using it off and on. You know, it's not, I don't have it set up with my work system. It's just for my personal one, so it's not quite as useful as it might normally be. But, you know, it lets me play with it without fear of, you know, data loss or anything like that. By data loss, I mean, you know, something at work going out to where it shouldn't go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I should mention that too. Microsoft Office app for iOS and Android. Okay. And, oh no, more ranting? More?
well, this is just one that we've talked a little bit about And that is the fact that I'm thinking about refreshing a number of my Apple items this year.
Yeah.
And I recently did the calculation, and it's going to be expensive. It's not going to be cheap. But one of the things that I have to do before I can do any of this cool stuff is I need to deal with my 27-inch cinema displays.
Yeah.
Because they are...
Wait, how many do you have?
2010. I have two of them.
Wow.
I have one in one office and one at home. I bought them both in 2010. They are the LED cinema display, so they are pre-Thunderbolt. They do not have... They're just mini display ports. And this is becoming a little bit frustrating in that it's apparently the way Apple does their implementation of mini DisplayPort, it needs an active translation from mini DisplayPort to a USB-C hub or USB-C adapter.
Hmm.
I did find one on Amazon that was about $16, but it will not work through a USB-C hub. It has to be plugged directly into the device. So I now have a hub on the way that has mini DisplayPort built in to try that out, because I really want to get down to just one plug that would go into a new MacBook.
Yeah.
But the annoying thing that I will caution everyone against, do not think this will work. Do not get all the adapters and everything you need to go from mini DisplayPort to HDMI and then plug into a lower-cost USB-C hub that supports HDMI. It will not work. Because of the way that it does need this active translation, in a sense, between mini display ports to USB-C. If you're just getting the cabling and you go from mini display port to HDMI to HDMI into a USB-C adapter, that probably will not work for you if you have those 2010-era USB-C or not USB-C, but those 2010-era cinema displays.
You know, I've actually had problems with display outs from pretty decent USB-C hubs, so I'm not surprised.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, for my Chromebook, I found I have an external display. Actually, it's a display used to be connected to my Windows device. And so when I go into work and I have my Chromebook sitting there, my cheap Chromebook sitting there, I can plug the monitor directly into... Let's see, is this true? I think I can plug the monitor directly into... the DisplayPort output from the Chromebook, but it won't work if I plug it into DisplayPort output in this USB-C hub. So, yeah. And I've had that problem with the fact I bought a USB-C monitor for home. You know, so I thought, oh, I could just plug it into anything, you know, draw power, blah, 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 and you know, power audio, video, right, in one cable. That doesn't really work. So, disappointing. Video is tough, I guess.
Yeah, it is, and it's one of those things... Also, that I think not many people still have these old cinema displays. You know, they are 10 years old now, and if anyone still has them around, all the blogs that you go to assume that you are actually referring to the Thunderbolt 2 or Thunderbolt 3 versions of the displays that came out in 2011 to 2015 or so.
Yeah.
So you have to be very careful. And that's one of the reasons why I'm trying to get these things now before I buy the things that I want to buy, because I don't want to have that moment of disappointment where I have a brand new shiny MacBook Pro and I go to plug it in and I can't use my giant 27-inch cinema display. That would just be very sad and unfortunate. So,
well, you know, all I can say, John, is, you know, so I met you when you were a really young guy. I think you hadn't finished your PhD yet. And it's been a while since you finished your PhD, and you've been a professor for a while. And I hate to tell you this, but this is what it's like when you get old. You just have a lot of stuff that's old but still works, and you want to keep using them. And you know what? It gets harder and harder as time goes by. Like, you know, if I did this years ago, but if I hadn't, if today I said, you know, it'd be nice if I recovered those files from all those zip drives. Disks I have. I don't have a Centronics port to plug my zip drive into anymore.
Well, you know, you say that, and it's funny. My wife and I last night were cleaning out some things in our kitchen, and we realized we had some kitchen gadgets and other stuff that we just never use, and bowls and plates and things like that. And she said something about, you know, do we have too much stuff and all this. I said, no, we just... about 5 years ago, we got everything we needed for life, in essence, you know, and it all works just fine. And we're not gonna rebuy certain things because we don't need to. We've got an X that works just fine now, but it does lead to some very strange things where you're like, well, you know, I could get a new blank. But I have an old one that works just fine. And it's the same thing with the cinema display. One of my friends just bought a wraparound 49-inch display. He paid $1,400 for it. It is beautiful. It totally immerses you. It's the same viewable size as having two 27-inch displays side by side.
Yeah.
But I probably won't get anything like that until these 27-inchers die, and I hope they don't die anytime soon.
I'm the same with TVs. And it applies to so many other things. You just mentioned kitchen utensils. I was talking to someone the other day, and there was some cabling that needed to be done somewhere, and so a friend said, hey, I haven't done it in a while, but I've got a crimper, and I can help these folks out. And so she goes over and grabs her crimper, and which she still had around, and she was offered to help the folks. And they looked at her and said, what is that you're holding? This is my crimper. I says, have you seen a modern crimper? this won't work for us. It'll be too slow,
Yeah. Isn't that funny? You just sort of, you get so used to the things that you have. And it's sort of like, and I have noticed this with my in-laws who are younger, since Carrie's the oldest of the family. All of my in-laws are younger. And my mother-in-law and father-in-law have gotten very frustrated with Christmas gift shopping because everyone has everything or is having everything, and so it's not like you could just give a
toaster
for a while. we'll give the boys power tools so that they have enough for their own home workshops and everything else. And then it was okay, we'll give them kitchen stuff they don't have yet, a nice convection oven or something like that. And now it's just like, well, everyone has everything, so thanks, but don't need it.
It's funny, isn't it? It's good funny, right? It's better than not having stuff you need, but it's a first world problem. It's a funny first world problem.
Yeah.
Okay. And now on to John's, I wish I had an announcer. And now on to John's R tip of the week.
Yeah, so for those of you that are just tuning in for the first time, the half of you that are just tuning in for the first time, or those of you that have missed a couple of weeks, I have a book that will be coming out at the end of the summer that is called Practical R4, and we've been talking about a tip of the week in R. And this week I have a little bit of code that does something really cool, and that is what's called web scraping. So if you are trying to get data and the only place it exists is on a static HTML web page, you can still get that data into R and you can still work with it. The thing that you have to do is you have to do a little bit of investigative work to figure out where that data is on that web page. So the package that I have a link to that we can put in the blog notes is called RVEST, R-V-E-S-T, all lowercase. And what it will let you do is download an HTML web page and parse the different nodes in HTML. And those nodes are broken down by CSS selectors. So you just have to kind of open up the HTML or use the inspect HTML tool in your browser to figure out what CSS nodes you're looking for. And then you can pretty easily track down the data you want and get it into an R data frame. So in the code, it basically downloads some information from the called IPEDS, the Integrated Post-Secondary Educational Data System, to get the number of faculty at an institution. I picked my home institution as the thing to do it. And then reports out, how many total faculty does this school have? So you can imagine if you were doing an analysis of how many faculty are at a number of different schools, you could just repeat this for as many different pages as you need it. IPEDS does offer actually some CSV file downloads, but I'm not sure if they actually would give you that information through there. That is a cool feature, but it does rely on one little thing, and that is that it is an HTML web page that you're downloading. If you go to certain web pages, especially live updating tickers, where, how many emails have been sent today, or how much this has happened, how much that has happened, your web page probably doesn't have the actual data you're looking for in the HTML, because the HTML has a placeholder that is then going to be filled with a JavaScript AJAX call later. So there's going to be a placeholder for the number. JavaScript will fire up. It'll start looking for where that placeholder is, then go out, fetch the data, put it in. And then this is how, if you've ever seen a ticker on a web page, kind of keep going up and up and up, it's doing that. That is a bit of a problem for R, because when you go to download the HTML, you just download something that says, you know, number goes here, and you're not going to want that. So the way that you can actually do that is by downloading a fully rendered version of the page. And I actually do have code in Chapter 9 of my book that shows how to do this using a lightweight web browser called PhantomJS. PhantomJS is a command line-based browser. All it does is download a rendered web page. It fully parses the JavaScript out. And so you can even still do web scraping with a rendered web page. You just have to use PhantomJS, which is an open source tool, so you can download that and call it from your R script, get the data, and then parse it as you normally would. But it's a little bit of a twist, and it takes a little bit more code. You have to write a quick JavaScript file to download the page for you. But it can be done. And if you think about it, there are a lot of times when you might want to get data, and the only place that data is at is on a web page. It's not a CSV file. It's not an Excel file. It's just something someone has posted or a report that they've posted. And you've got to get that data out of there.
All right. And so for details, wait a couple months. And then you can read Chapter 9 of Practical R4.
Yep. Chapter 9 is a cool chapter that talks about doing alert managers. So, you know, when this number goes above this number, send me a push notification or something like that. So ideal for people who are looking for changes in web pages or changes in reports, and they would like to be proactively told that versus having to check it every so often to see what's going on.
All right. Nice. I've only fired up RStudio once, but I've got it installed on my Chromebook. Maybe I'll even put it on my Windows book. As you're just saying, if you're going to replace your MacBook, speaking of going back to the Mac, your expenses for this year, you at least will not have to deal with a terrible butterfly keyboard that I have, that I'm using right now.
I went past that. I did actually realize that was one of the things I wanted to avoid. So if I had thought about upgrading last year, I did not, for that reason alone.
Yeah.
Plus, I also, you know, I've been kind of curious how long my 2015 MacBook Pro will still be completely usable without it getting annoyingly slow or something like that. It started to show its age, but it's not that bad right now.
Yeah, I can't remember. You know, I remember why I upgraded my. I have so I inherited a 2017. No, that's not right. 2013. So it's slightly older than yours. I inherited a 2013 MacBook Air from my daughter when she graduated from college, and I got her a new MacBook Air. And it was getting a little bit pokey. You know, it's still good, but just slightly pokey on a few things. And I thought, well, you know, I haven't actually bought a new MacBook for myself since 2010. Mm-hmm. You know, V2 of the MacBook Air in 2010, the first good one. And so I said, yeah, every 10 years, I guess I can splurge and buy a new thing. And there was that threat of tariffs being placed on items manufactured in China. So I said, I might as well just buy one before the whole tariff thing goes out. And if my, you know, hopefully my MacBook Air or the 2013 MacBook Air is still running fine, although it does tend to heat up. But at any rate, maybe I'll sell this one and buy a new MacBook Pro just to get rid of the keyboard.
Can't blame that one on me. You were already thinking about it.
Oh, so yeah, yeah. I can't blame John.
Yeah.
All right. And here's a funny one, because, they say great minds think alike. In this case, they're just John is a great mind and plus me.
Yeah.
But John's great mind thought about something, and I happened to think about the same thing without a great mind, so I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, yeah. You know, GarageBand is an awesome app that is really fun to play with. If you have played an instrument in the past, or you know how to read music, or you know anything about music theory, you really can get a lot out of it. And even if you don't know much about music, you can still get a lot out of playing around with GarageBand.
True.
But one of the things that's always been very daunting for me is, how do I even do some of the cool stuff I see? You know, you see people create whole songs and all these other sorts of things. Every time I've looked for a GarageBand tutorial, it's way more basic than I need. You know, this is what a piano keyboard looks like. This is what a time signature is, things like that. And I think, well, you know, I played mediocre violin for 6 years in high school. Yeah, so, well, you know, prior to high school and high school, I wasn't in high school for 6 years. But I did play mediocre violin for a while. And I do know how to read music and know how to count time and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So what I just want to know is where are all these cool features that let you do cool things? And there are a number of videos now on YouTube, and both Todd and I found these sort of separately, that are people who basically take a video of them tapping out everything you need to do to create iconic songs. And so one of the ones that I watched this week was Gangsta's Paradise, the Coolio song. And you see them lay down the percussion and then the bass and then the melody on top of it. But if you've ever wondered how you do those things and exactly what buttons you press and what options you use, these are really cool. You might have to slow them down a little bit in order to see exactly what they're tapping, because they do go very fast because they know the app very well. But it's really enlightened me onto how GarageBand operates and how to really use it to its full potential. So I don't know if I'll be composing anything cool anytime soon. But I do enjoy watching these and trying here and there to follow along on my own app.
Yeah, I subscribe to a fellow who goes by iPiano Dude on YouTube. And his channel, it's fascinating because he recreates entire arrangements on an iPhone, not even an iPad. You know, so he's tapping and pecking away in an iPhone, and the end result is just usually amazing. Really talented fellow. I think he's a fella. You only see the fingers, but I think it's a guy. And, well, he does call himself iPiano Dude, so, you know, versus Dudette or something. So, but at any rate, very talented fellow and well worth watching some of his stuff. You may not be familiar with all of the music he does, but there's a couple there you probably will be. For me, mostly it's because I'm old and I don't know new songs. Found his stuff to be quite amazing. Okay, well, that brings us to the end of yet another Mobile Views podcast. Before we started, told John, well, this will probably be less than 20 minutes, but because the last one was kind of short, but no, we stretched it out to like almost 50 minutes. So not sure how that happened, but fun as usual.
We're just really good at what we do.
Alrighty, well, that's Mobile Views podcast 327 is in the can. We'll talk to you next time.